Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The eighth round of the Vienna talks in Austria is approaching a break before it resumes after the new year. Its continuation and the pace of progress is viewed as positive by Iran and some other signatories to the JCPOA agreement, but not for the party that pulled out, namely the U.S., just said that the pace of the talks is too slow. Why is the U.S. in what appears to be a rush, unlike its position when the talks began? Just one of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. We earlier talked to our correspondent in Vienna, Homolesky, for the latest on the talks.
As of now, Iran is saying that it will is sticking to its position of wanting verification and guarantees from the Americans when it comes to sanctions removal. It says these are the proposals that it's put forward, and Iran's team says it sees this as a good sign that the other side, the other parties, have acknowledged that this is and should be part of the negotiations. Because initially, we're talking earlier, you told me about this criticism against the French delegation. It looks like, for instance, initially that delegation and the other Europeans were not even willing to consider these issues to be on the agenda. Then there was some progress made. These were issues that were included. You know, when we're talking about why Iran is insisting on this verification and guarantee issue, we know that when the JCPOA was signed in 2015, what happened was that the Trump administration withdrew in 2018 without giving Iran the economic benefit, and on top of that, imposed the maximum pressure policy on the country and secondary sanctions that also stopped any other European or international countries, firms or companies from working with Iran. So in spite of all that, Iran stayed committed to its obligations for another whole year, and then it started gradually withdrawing from the JCPOA itself. And now Mr. Barzani is saying because it was the U.S. that violated the deal, there is, of course, this leads to a lack of trust between the two sides. What's important for Iran, if it, that trust is going to be built, is to get this effective guarantee and verification.
Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who joins us from London. Also joining us is Frank Emspach, who's a political analyst, joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome both of you to this edition of The Spotlight, and I'd like to first start with you, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas. What is the reason for the what appears to be these time constraints in the negotiations, which is coming from what is the U.S. side in particular? Are we looking at something that they are not seeing when it comes to the others who are saying that the pace of the negotiations in this eighth round is going rather well?
Well, I think we know what the attitudes of the Americans is, and we know who's pulling the strings behind the Americans. It is Israel, and Israel has stated very clearly they want these negotiations to fail. They have no intention of allowing America to come into an agreement. Now, it's a question of whether the U.S. really has real autonomy and the courage to be able to take the right stand, the just stand, the stand which will bring far more stability to the Middle East, or whether they're going to continue listening to their advisors in Tel Aviv, who seem to want a complete collapse of the JCPOA agreements from the day dot. Of course, the fact is that Iran has done everything it can in order not to pull out of these agreements, in spite of the fact that not only did the Americans pull out unilaterally completely from this agreement which they signed, they also made sure that the Europeans would be very, very scared to do anything without them, given all the sanctions that they were imposing and all of the other sanctions they were willing to impose on European businesses. So, of course, Iran is absolutely right to demand the Americans show cleanly how they're going to abide by whatever agreement emerges, if it emerges. So in the first place, getting to an agreement is first of all the obligation of the Americans, okay, primarily, because they're the ones who pulled out completely. What can they put on the table to assure Iran that they will do what everybody else agrees at this, sure, at this juncture?
Well, Frank Emsak, what they can do is they can reach an agreement in some respects, and the best and quickest way is to lift the sanctions and the post-sanctions and then to return to their obligations under the agreement if they're so in a rush for time here, as they have stated, in particular the U.S. So why don't they do that?
Well, because I think that the United States is a past master in public relations, and the way they have in the press today, or at least the broadcast media, in the print media, incidentally, there was nothing today in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or any local press about the talks, which is, I thought, sort of interesting. But in any event, the way it's placed here is that somehow the Iranians are at fault for not agreeing right away. I think, though, that although Israel certainly is playing a role here, there's no question about that, I also think that it's not a good idea to underestimate the strength of the anti-Iranian sort of pro-Cold War sort of old-fashioned wing of both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And then when we get to guarantees legally in the United States, I think what it's hard to understand is that, yes, you can have a president saying, I signed something. But what really is the law is when the Senate passes this as a treaty. And I think the Biden administration, even those that might want to work out something with Iran, have a real problem here, because it's unlikely that a treaty could be voted on in the Senate as things stand now. And of course, in about 8 months or 10 months, when there's elections, it may change even more so for the worse. So there's a real problem here on the guarantee issue. That's the first thing. The second thing is that I do not see, and this is a great source of worry to any of us who would like to go back to the treaty, there is very little discussion or push, at least publicly, within the Democratic Party to move forward here. It's almost as if these negotiations are going on in some closet someplace and nobody knows much. But you don't hear anything, you don't see much from the administration. And there does not seem to be a vocal group in the Senate saying we should get this done. And that is a real source of concern, at least to me.
Why is that?
Well, I think that a couple of reasons, that the Iranian issue has not risen to the surface in a certain way. I think that the Democrats want to avoid it. And I think people are frightened in another way. you have the administration hinting that if things don't work out, maybe there'll be some kind of war. Nobody wants that. And so in a certain sense, one way to try to deal with it is never to discuss it. I don't think that's going to that's very helpful.
Okay, well, let me see what Seymour Sinabas thinks. Let's see what Seymour Sinabas thinks. Seymour Sinabas, our guest there, Frank Enspach, says it doesn't seem like there's a sense of urgency, or, if I can say that, or that the Democrats don't seem to really be reacting the way they should in terms of for this thing to happen. But isn't that sending a wrong signal in a sense? Or it seems like the mind is not made up. On the one hand, Americans accuse Iran, they're wasting time, they're not reaching an agreement, they're on their path to a nuclear bomb. And on the second hand, they just don't seem to be sending signals as to what direction they want this to go. At least from the outside looking at, that's what it appears. Do you see that way?
I tend to agree with you. The thing that is really a problem for them is that Iran has a ballistic missile capability which is second to nobody in the Middle East, certainly in West Asia, and they're ranking right up there amongst all of the big guns of the world in terms of being able to land heavy-hitting defense missiles on anybody who decides to attack them. And this is the only thing, I think, other than perhaps China and Russia being supportive of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which prevents or has prevented the Americans doing exactly what the Israelis want and exactly what the pro-Israel lobby wants them to do, which is to launch an attack on the Iranians and to knock out those nuclear installations which they claim are ready to produce weapons level, if you like, capability. Now, the reality, in fact, is that deterrent makes it, I think, almost impossible for either the Israelis or the Americans to really consider a strike without serious consequences. I mean, Iran has made it patently clear that anything that happens of that kind will result in Tel Aviv knowing about it. They'll certainly be able to reach Tel Aviv with their weaponry. I think this is the key, that the Americans are therefore panicking, and so are the Israelis, because they don't really have the negotiation chips really on the ground to be able to make their threats pay.
Well, let's see what Frank Enspach thinks here. I'm sorry to jump in. Just to get an idea about that point being made, Frank Enspach, that Seymour Sinabas, about Iran's, in a sense, military might overall. And I'd like to ask you about how it is, if it's connected in any sense, where you have these military drills that Iran just held, and it ended 5 days ago. They were massive. There were extensive military drills along the coastlines. And just a few days later, you have the headlines that came out, which said that, for example, one of them, about Israel Bennett, Israel's not opposed to a good nuclear deal, as he calls it, with Iran. I mean, I don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but, we have had so many threats, which are illegal, coming from Israel against Iran, and then now this headline came out, and this comes out from an Israeli publication.
Yeah, well, it comes up and it says an agreement that they would agree to, that they like, so who knows what that is. I think Israel was clearer yesterday morning when they attacked Syria on the basis that there might be an Iranian cargo ship or an Iranian container containing military spare parts that the Syrians need, so they blew up the Syrians' container port. I think that's what really Israel is. I think what's going on here is something that's really fundamental to the way in which the United States has conducted foreign policy for many, many years, and that is that they're faced with a group of people, the Iranians here, who have an independent view of how they want the world to run, which is different than the United States' view, and that the United States has had a hard time accepting that over the years. And I think that's a real fundamental and unspoken part of the American thinking. And when you read their documents, you see that. Like, who are these people? Who do they think to tell us what to do? Take the overall situation. The United States is trying to get Ukraine, which was part of the Soviet Union, 50 years ago, 30 years ago, to join NATO. Can you imagine what would happen here if the Canadians were in a military alliance with somebody? People would be hysterical here. And I think that there is just simply no willingness on the part of the administration, any administration, to begin to really think about what it's going to be like not to be the top dog 100% of the time telling everybody what to do. And there's a strong, strong cultural bias here in that regard.
That's
and that
it.
Is what is so difficult here, because it has to be overcome if we're going to get a treaty.
Well, I mean, this is not what Iran is saying, Sayyid Mohsin Abbas. I'm looking at the Iranian Foreign Minister, Amir Abdullahian, in his most recent statements. The negotiating sides have reached a unified joint text, which is currently the focus of the Iranian team, along with things like the negotiations are moving in a good direction. An agreement is possible if other parties show goodwill and seriousness. So either there's a disconnect, either there's something that's going on behind closed doors. Of course, Iran doesn't talk directly with the U.S. That the U.S. doesn't want the world to know, because we're looking at almost opposite ends of the spectrum here in terms of what's being relayed out of the Vienna talks.
Yes, I think the Iranians have taken a tactical decision to keep upbeat, to be positive, to go in with all, if you like, options open, and they've been trying to, do the best they can, I think, for the original agreement to be re-ratified. What's happening minutiae in the details is rather irrelevant, to be honest. I would say the fact of the matter is that Iran will never completely pull out from wanting its ability to use nuclear technology for peaceful means. That's perfectly legitimate and absolutely fine. It will, I think, sincerely pull out of making it any of their nuclear program weapons capable or nuclear armed. I think that's been made clear by the leader, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, time and time again, that there is an actual religious edict which everybody chooses to ignore, and the supreme leader has made it clear that he regards nuclear weapons, and the scholars that basically preside over Iran's future and its foreign policy and welfare based on moral ethical grounds, they don't want the weapon. They say the nuclear weapon targets civilians,
sure,
women and children, and on those grounds, Iran simply doesn't want it. I take Ayatollah Khamenei's word very seriously. The Americans and the Israelis clearly can't, because that's the kind of politics they play. They don't believe anything a moral, ethical man or his administration says.
Trying to follow some logic, Frank Imsbach, and I'm looking again at one of the U.S. positions that has been actually reiterated at some points, especially in the beginning of the talks, and that is that they've said we have a long way to go to revive the JCPOA, when they talked about how 5 months has passed. And this is with the new Iranian administration coming into work, they had this positive spin on it, so to speak, but saying that we have a long ways to go. Almost at every turn, this was reiterated. But now they're saying, why aren't we reaching a point, whether it's an agreement or a disagreement? Again, trying to figure out the U.S. position here and as to why they're taking this most recent stance, which is that they're not, the discussions are not moving, or the talks are not moving fast enough.
It's hard to know, but obviously when the Biden administration came into power last January, they could have moved very quickly by simply beginning to alleviate and raise and eliminate some of the sanctions, and they chose not to do that. And I think that those who have said that the United States' initial game plan was to try what Trump was doing was right, that's what we, the United States government, tried to do, and it didn't work. So now there is a problem as far as they're concerned. But again, the fundamental question is, are they committed to a treaty? And is there political pressure here to do it? Or, in fact, are they looking over their shoulder and that they're more worried about the political pressure from the right and from a certain segment of the Democratic Party not to do it? Because the obvious propaganda attack on Biden is going to be that somehow or other he lost Iran, as if it was his in the first place.
Sure.
And you're going to see this kind of political attack here. And I think they have not come up with the solution to it internally.
All right. Let me ask the final question to say, Mohsen Abbas. You know, if I'm the Iranian team listening to what Frank Imspach is saying, the Democrats, well, maybe they don't really want a deal or they don't want an agreement. I would obviously ask for what Iran has asked for, and that is that guarantee as to whether the U.S. is going to stay in this agreement. How do you think that can come about? Do you think it will come about? And do you think that agreement at this point is even feasible?
Unofficially, or officially, my opinion is that Iran doesn't care. Iran doesn't care if America comes back into this deal or not. The Islamic Republic of Iran has made it patently clear that they can return if they lift those sanctions, those illegal, internationally illegal sanctions, which the Americans have gone absolutely crazy. In history, I don't think any nation, perhaps other than Nazi Germany, has had the scale of sanctions imposed by the Americans on a global level as Iran has in this instance. And what is it merited for this? It's basically developing nuclear, if you like, technology which allows it to use it as energy. For that crime, supposed crime, they've gone to all these lengths. So, of course, there's something more going on. The reality of the situation is why Iran doesn't really care, in my opinion, is that they've already started making huge inroads into alternatives. They don't need the West now. They don't need economically to be with the West. It's fine if it happens, great. But the future for Iran is Eurasia. It's China and Russia. And the more the Americans play this belligerent game of economic sanctions, more they're pushing nations like Iran into the arms of rising China and a re-emerging Russia. I think that ultimately is where the future lies.
Thank you so much. We're fresh out of time, but I do thank Sayyid Mohsen Abbas there with his comments, journalist and political commentator from London. Frank Imspach, a pleasure. Thank you so much. Political analyst there from Madison.
Thank you.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batakhwa, the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat and the Sutuh. the standard time for studying the Muqaddimat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Jawid, we are talking about the Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas about prayer rules and Islamic laws related to prayer. Is it in fact permissible to offer the tahajjud prayer or the night prayer or the nafila of night after Isha prayer?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. According to all religious authorities, it is highly recommended to offer the tahajjud prayer or the nafila of night moments before the fajr, the time for fajr prayer. For example, half an hour before the time for fajr prayer is highly recommended. That's the best time, yes, in which the nawafil of night can be offered, or the tahajjud prayer, you know. But
and easy to do so for Muslims during Ramadan, because yeah, they rise up, they get out of their bed, in fact, to have a little, let's say, food, before the Fajr prayer, so that they can also offer their night prayer.
And that's the, yes, of
but,
course.
But it's not very easy in non-Ramadan, in fact, nights.
Yeah, you're right, because maybe the nights are very short, yes, and people maybe they are tired, they are busy doing things, and it's very difficult. Some kind of, you know, it can be very much painstaking sometimes for a person to wake up or to even make an arrangement for the night prayer,
yes,
you know. So for people who find it extremely or very difficult to wake up before dawn, the religious authorities have said that it is permissible to offer the tahajjud prayer any time after Isha. So, like, for example, before going to bed, you can offer your prayer. And, of course, you will earn the sawab of the tahajjud prayer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It is permissible. And even if, for example, if you happen to miss these prayers, you miss the namaz tahajjud or that nawafil of night,
yes,
then it is even possible to offer the qadha the next day, anytime on the following day, you can offer the qada of these prayers, and obviously you will gain the sawab of those prayers.
I guess this is the only nawafil or recommended prayer that has a qada.
Qada, yes.
In fact, for it, right?
You're right.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Sheikh. Is it also permissible for a Muslim to offer his or her prayer with two intentions? In fact, like for example, making the intention of a tahajjud or the qaza of the fajr prayer.
This is one of the very frequently asked questions.
Mm-hmm.
Many people want to know whether they can do two things at the same time,
yes,
like offering fajr prayer and also making niyyah of tahajjud, because they both of them, both tahajjud and fajr prayer consist of two rakats.
Yes.
So it would be very much, it could have been very good if they could make such a niyyah.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously the religious authorities have said clearly that it's not permissible to offer one prayer with two niyyat, with two intentions.
Yes.
Yeah, no matter what the prayer, the prayers are, it's not permissible.
I see. Okay. Sheikh, let's take a short break and we'll be back continuing our discussion and Islamic laws related to prayer.
Sure.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islam Gloss on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, talking about Ayatollah Khamenei's Islamic laws on prayer. Well, Sheikh, is it permissible for a Muslim to offer the recommended prayers while moving, walking, flying?
Yes, it is permissible to offer those prayers while moving, you know. For example, if you are, let's say, on a bus, or while you're maybe riding your motorbike, still you can offer a mustahab prayer. The thing is that mustahab prayers are you know, recommend prayers. There's nothing mandatory about those prayers, so there's a kind of flexibility about those prayers. So for example, if you are working, if you are a worker working in a factory, you are working, doing your work. At the same time, as you continue to work, you can make niyyah of a mustahab prayer. And of course, for some acts, you will have to, you know, even if you change your position, sometimes making, facing another direction, not the direction of Qibla, that doesn't affect the prayer. The prayer remains valid. And as far as sujood is concerned, you don't have to do the sujood in a regular way, you know. You just can put something on your forehead with your hand, and the prayer is still valid. It's not necessary to offer, to perform the ruku in the sujood in the regular way. Yes. So just to make a gesture or bow your head a little bit to suggest that, or to indicate that you are doing ruku, it will be sufficient.
I see. But what about the obligatory prayers? Is it permissible to offer obligatory prayers while moving?
No, no.
Like if you are in a flight.
Oh, that is something
else.
Or on
a ship.
That is something else.
Yes, it is moving, isn't it?
Yes, you're right. You know, because it's not permissible to miss your prayer under any circumstances.
Exactly.
So when you are on board a ship, of course, the ship is moving, it is jolting, you know, so, of course, you can't help about it, you know.
So not only I'm talking about the passengers, but also the flight attendant are sometimes Muslims from Muslim countries.
Yeah.
The pilot, the captain, the sea person or
sailors,
the sailors, you know, they are where, you know,
this is where they work, basically.
You're right.
And they are on a ship, the crew of a ship, or the flight attendant of a flight, probably.
You're right.
So what should they do?
Of course, all the religious authorities have said that prayers cannot be missed.
Yes.
Under any circumstances, even if you are on your deathbed, you must still say your prayer. Mm-hmm. Even if you cannot move your tongue, you have to pray using your eyes and making your and making gestures with your eyes,
yes,
to suggest that you do ruku and sujood. For people who are, let's say, on a cruise ship, or for people who, for flight attendants, or for travelers on board an airplane, of course, they have to pray and they have to offer their prayers in whatever manner possible,
mm-hmm,
okay? Facing the direction of Qibla, they have to adjust themselves towards the Qibla. If the ship or the airplane is moving left and right and the changing direction every few minutes, you know,
yes,
he has to position himself towards the Qibla. Even if he is moving, but when the flight is, when his body is moving,
mm-hmm,
maybe violently sometimes, he shouldn't recite the zikr, okay? Because it's very much important to keep your body steady, to keep your body motionless,
yes,
and to keep it still. Steadiness of the prayer of the body is one of the conditions that must be met.
Yes.
As far as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But it depends from person to person and situation to situation.
Yes.
If you are in your room offering your prayers, if you are offering your prayers at home, of course you shouldn't move. Even you shouldn't move your hands and legs and your body and your head.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important to be motionless during
right.
prayer. And unfortunately, I have seen many of my friends who do not care about that, this very important condition. They move their legs even sometimes, and sometimes they change their legs. They move their arms, and their arms are dangling, you know,
uh-huh,
on both sides. Because it
does that make their prayer void?
It affects their prayer. If you are moving while uh-huh reciting zikr, the religious authorities, including Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, has said that it is necessary as a measure of obligatory precaution to repeat that zikr,
uh-huh,
to say it again.
Yes.
To say it again. So it's very important to keep your body steady and motionless. Now, when it comes to people, flight attendants and people on a cruise ship, they should also try to be motionless,
mm-hmm,
and not to recite zikr when their body is being moved.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yes.
So they should face the Qibla. Qibla is one of the essential and necessary conditions that must be fulfilled.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh, for your nice contribution to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, signing out. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun Rahimun Mannanun Kareemun Salamun Aleemun La ilaha illa hum Ghaffarun Jameelun Wahhabun Latifun Tawwabun Samiun Basirun وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
The United States has approved its biggest defense spending bill in history, allocating $778 billion for the fiscal year 2022. President Joe Biden signed the National Defense Authorization Act into law on Monday following Congress approval. The proposed defense spending is up about 5% compared to the previous year. However, the surprising part of the story is that Congress has allocated about $25 billion more for the military than the Biden administration had requested for. The budget allocates over $740 billion to the Pentagon, while nearly $28 billion would go to the nuclear weapons program. A good portion will be spent on hypersonic weapons and other advanced weaponry, raising the fear of another arms race with Russia. It ensures that the U.S. gives around $3.8 billion to Israel as part of its annual military aid to the regime. But around $7 billion of the hefty defense budget is for what the U.S. calls the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, a plan to strengthen America's presence in the Indo-Pacific region against China. That also means an open call for support for Taiwan, which China regards as its own territory. The budget also envisages $300 million in military aid for Ukraine, which has been a source of tensions between Russia and the U.S.-led Western military alliance, NATO. Many experts believe that Washington's claim of defending Taiwan or Ukraine are just pretexts to make the U.S. military-industrial complex more profitable.
The military-industrial complex in the States, it really controls the economy. This idea that America's trying to defend Taiwan or Ukraine, these are just pretexts for the profits of the military-industrial complex.
According to data released by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute in April, the massive U.S. military budget was by far the largest in the world in 2021. That was more than the budget of 11 other developed and developing countries combined. That despite the fact that COVID-19 forced many countries, such as South Korea and Russia, to shift part of their planned military spending to pandemic response. Critics argue that the unwarranted increase in defense budget could instead be diverted to address more urgent domestic priorities, such as social injustice or fighting against the pandemic. The critics also say that the budget is more than enough to vaccinate everyone in the world. In July, an anti-war group, Code Pink, warned that the proposed $25 billion hike in the Pentagon budget alone could end homelessness in the United States. The group accused lawmakers of trying to increase the profits of military contractors than meeting the needs of working class. The approved military spending bill also represents a bump from former President Donald Trump's last budget of $740 billion, which was then criticized by Biden's fellow Democrats. Upon entering the White House in January, President Biden had pledged a massive overhaul of U.S. strategy toward the world to make it a better place. However, Biden continues to follow Trump's aggressive and warmongering policies, as the National Defense Authorization Act reflects that billions of dollars will go for the U.S. unending wars across the globe.
Hundreds of people demonstrated in Gaza City in solidarity with female Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. Protesters marched towards the Legislative Council building while shouting slogans against Israel and expressing their unwavering support for the prisoners. In recent weeks, Israeli forces increased their attacks against Palestinian female prisoners. The issue of female Palestinian prisoners is highly emotive to all Palestinians. The protest was organized by the Al-Ahrar movement.
Palestinian female prisoners are being attacked inside Israeli prisons, and we will not remain silent. Attacking female prisoners is an attack on the honor of all Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims. They were beaten and their ribs were broken by the prison guards. We stand by the prisoners and we will spare no effort to secure their release from Zionist jails.
Palestinians believe that Israel can only be forced into releasing Palestinian inmates under prisoner swap deals. In late 2011, Hamas and the Israeli regime signed a prisoner swap deal, under which Israeli soldier Gal Shalit was released in exchange for over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the issue of Palestinian female prisoners is a red line that must not be crossed at any given time. Attacking and humiliating Palestinian female prisoners will not go unpunished. The Israeli regime will have to face all the consequences of attacking the female prisoners. As we stand here today, we say to all Palestinian prisoners that the resistance factions will always support them and that we will soon liberate them from Zionist jails.
Palestinian prisoners, including females, are kept in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers and are being subjected to torture and psychological pressures by Israeli prison authorities.
The Zionist regime is trying to commit genocide against Palestinian prisoners amid the silence and normalization of Arab regimes. We call on all Muslims to stand by Palestinian prisoners because Palestinian prisoners are fighting for a just cause. We have also sent a strong warning to the Zionist enemy over the issue of female Palestinian prisoners.
According to legal experts, the Israeli regime has long regarded itself above international laws and norms, due to the protection it enjoys from some countries like the United States.
People here are demanding international action to support Palestinian prisoners' struggle for freedom. Israel currently incarcerates some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners, including scores of women and children. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The Saudi war on Yemen has been ongoing for more than 7 years now. Far from home, Yemeni students in Iran gathered in Tehran to commemorate the victims of the war.
We Yemeni students have gathered here today to once again shed light on Saudi Arabia's crimes in our country. Saudi Arabia is bombarding innocent children and women in our country. Why is the UN keeping mum? Where is the Human Rights Watch? Aren't we considered human?
Saudi Arabia launched the war on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing former Yemeni President Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi back to power. The Yemeni army and its allied forces are leading the anti-Saudi resistance in the country. They say while Saudi Arabia is enjoying all-out support from its Western allies in its war, Yemeni forces have made headways against the invaders, turning the devastating war into a costly quagmire for Riyadh.
Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve its goals in our country. We have resisted for more than 7 years and shifted the balance in our favor. Despite the use of American and British arms, Riyadh will never be able to impose its will on our nation.
The ongoing bombardment of civilian facilities has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead and destroyed the infrastructure of the impoverished country. Not to mention the spread of infectious diseases and famine. Saudi Arabia has also imposed an all-out blockade against Yemen.
The Saudi war on Yemen is condemned here as a crime against humanity, a crime that continues to be ignored by the responsible entities in the world. Yemeni students here say this means it's up to the Yemeni people to take the matter into their own hands and continue their resistance until the country is finally free. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
With France's presidential election just 4 months away, Europe's largest Muslim community is being scapegoated and targeted by government repression as badly as ever. Almost 100 mosques have recently been raided by the government, with at least 24 shut down so far. Earlier this year, a so-called anti-separatist law was accused of basically legalizing Islamophobia, as it tried to ban the hijab for minors and force the closure of not just mosques, but highly respected Muslim NGOs such as the Collective Against French Islamophobia. The latest assault on freedom of religion for French Muslims has been sharply criticized by foreign leaders and top NGOs.
France is a republic which claims to be very attached to the idea that the state must be neutral towards all religions. But the past year has seen an incredibly tough interference and meddling in the Muslim community. They're entering mosques and telling religious leaders to say this and to not say that. And this reflects the shift to the extreme right of President Emmanuel Macron's government.
The dominant theme of France's entire presidential election has shifted to the extreme right, as convicted racist Eric Zemmour has provided coronavirus-era France with almost nightly Islamophobic diatribes. Zemmour has rocketed to third place in the polls, giving Macron and other candidates license to blame Muslims for France's economic and political problems.
Zemmour resembles Donald Trump of the United States in that both thrive on outrage, but there are significant differences. Zemmour's entire career has been based around trying to be a part of the political scene and conversation, and he has benefited from support from major parts of the French establishment the entire time.
Il est invité dans tous les plateaux.
Zemmour is invited onto all the television news programs, even though he's a political pyromaniac who is trying to rehabilitate the era of Vichy France, when France collaborated with the German Nazis. He's very dangerous for all of France, and not just France's Muslims, because he's appealing to those who sympathize with the era of French colonial barbarism.
Ever since the Great Recession began, France's political and media elite have stigmatized Muslims to a degree which has gutted the nation's claim to be a global leader in freedom of religion, thought, and speech. The three most popular candidates in the presidential election all seem to be trying to outdo each other in Islamophobia, which has France's Muslims expecting the state-sponsored racism to be even worse over the next 4 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks says the eighth round of negotiations aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action will be focusing on the two issues of verification and guarantees.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has announced that if an agreement is reached, the side that violated the deal, meaning the U.S., should remove the sanctions first. Iran should verify the removal of sanctions and only then take measures within the framework of the JCPOA.
Ali Bagheri Kani says the U.S., which withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 under the administration of Donald Trump, also needs to provide guarantees it will not withdraw again or impose sanctions in violation of the deal.
Iran's rightful and logical demand has been getting guarantees from the other side, and this, as well as the issue of verification, have in principle been accepted by them. But discussions need to take place on the mechanism, frameworks and criteria involved in order to reach a framework for an agreement.
Bagheri said the sides are set to discuss banking and financial sanctions in the coming days. Meanwhile, EU coordinator Enrico Mora says the talks need to end within a reasonable period of time, which, according to him, should be a matter of weeks rather than months. Mora said difficult political decisions need to be made, both in Tehran and Washington. Iran says if the other side shows it's ready to effectively remove sanctions and give the necessary guarantees, the talks can conclude successfully. Talks will continue at the level of experts and deputy foreign ministers in the coming days as efforts intensify to make the challenging prospect of a restored JCPOA a reality. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
It was the year UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson pledged to build back better. Some critics argued this was not just about restoring the UK's fiscal position after the ravages of COVID on the economy, but on reviving the country's international reputation that had taken a global hit after a few glaring missteps. If Johnson was hoping for a glorious scorecard to see out his political year, he was going to be left disappointed. Not only had he failed to make vital political inroads on the international stage, some pointed to the UK having gone backwards in some respects.
Britain no longer has this huge empire that it once had. It doesn't have a presence in any serious sense east of Suez. It was badly defeated in Afghanistan over the summer. That's 20 years of war, which has shown that we've come completely full circle as a result of that war. And therefore, Britain is being kind of cut down to size, I think, in terms of, you know, when people look at it. Its actual role in the world is much less.
For those expecting something different when it came to the sometimes subservient relationship that exists between Washington and London, well, 2021 was yet another year of disappointment, with the US setting the political agenda and Britain following that well-trodden path.
The White House meeting between the U.S. President Joe Biden and Britain's bumbling PM underscored the power imbalance between the two nations. After the trade deals dangled by the Trump administration failed to materialize, Johnson returned from Washington with nothing like the $300 billion in agreements, not that you'd sense the crushing disappointment at the time.
Then, of course, there's the progress that we're making in the defense technology partnership that you've led and with our Australian friends. That I think has great potential to benefit the whole of the world and the security of the whole of the world. So, Joe, thank you for having us. And I think you know we're boosting our shared agenda. We want to build back the world together with you. And I think we want to renew and strengthen our transatlantic bond. And it feels to me like it's going very, very well.
The shambolic withdrawal and embarrassing military climb down experienced by Britain's military after the US announced it was leaving Afghanistan exposed the UK's strategic weaknesses and had the minister in charge at the time attempting to explain the chaos away.
Of course, didn't put.
So that's a lie.
We did not put the welfare of animals above individuals.
I'm not
accusing anyone of lying, I'm just correcting the facts. What is certainly true is that we had a lot of people rushing to get out of Afghanistan for all sorts of reasons. And I think it's right that we had a process in place.
Not only was the UK caught on the back foot having to follow the US on the Afghanistan issue, its foreign policy position continues to ape Washington agenda on China, Russia, Iran, Yemen, and Palestine, to name but a few. Perhaps the only area of foreign policy divergence is Brexit, where Washington has reiterated its pro-Brussels sentiments.
Britain's most complicated and increasingly acrimonious foreign policy situation is the one that London and Brussels now find themselves in. Having exited the European Union, Britain now finds itself at odds with its former ally. A situation that has not been this bad in decades.
Lord Frost passing the job of securing Britain's post-Brexit policies onto Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, it will be an uphill task for 2022.
The trade deals that Britain has made since Brexit have amounted to very little, including there hasn't been one with the United States. And therefore, Britain is sort of desperately trying to cling on to this military role, while at the same time the wider economic issues are not necessarily going in their favour.
Britain's continued political pivot towards the US remains a risky strategy that has yet to bear genuine fruits for the UK in its own aims. With the country's Prime Minister still in bombastic, flag-waving mood, perhaps Boris Johnson feels tethering the UK's fortunes so closely to that of the US is still the way to go, despite new global realities indicating otherwise. Amina Taylor, London.
A meeting was held here in Western Kabul to bring the Islamic Emirate and the people closer together. The meeting was organized by a Shia association to pave the way for national solidarity in Afghanistan. During the meeting, the religious leaders and the Taliban officials stressed the need for mutual trust between people and the government.
One of the main responsibilities of the ruling group is nation building. Afghan nation is mainly composed of our Shia and Sunni brothers. We are part of United Ummah of Islam. In order to have a united Afghanistan, we should trust each other and rely on mutual values. The new government needs to represent all sections and ethnicities of Afghanistan.
Conspiracy is one of US and the Soviet Union's main heritages in our country. They destroyed the soil with it. The Islamic Emirate need to find a way for creating unity in Afghanistan. We are all Muslims, and we believe in God. Anyone who lives in Afghanistan is entitled to live in peace and play the role in the reconstruction of the country.
The religious leaders warn against foreign interference in Afghanistan and stress the urgency to get united.
The only thing that our country needs is peace and unity.